Hello, welcome to the Healthy Bottom Line podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, the senior editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Today, we're talking with Dr. Mirza Rahman, president of the American College of Preventive Medicine. He talks about the need for preventive medicine and the glaring lack of support for residency programs in preventive medicine. It's a really interesting discussion, so please join us. Well, thank you for joining us today. We're talking with Dr. Mirza Rahman, the president of the American College of Preventive Medicine. Doctor, thanks for taking time to talk to us today.
Thank you for having me in the program, Ron.
Let's start with a very basic question. Just talk about the role of the American College of Preventive Medicine and sort of the ACPM's mission.
The ACPM, founded in 1954, is focused on prevention. And by that, what we mean is we look at population health. We're looking at the broader well-being of patients and communities all across the United States. We're an organization of about 2,000 physicians, and we work primarily in areas where you would think of state or national or local health areas. So we're talking about agencies that you're familiar with, like the Food and Drug Administration, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or your state or local health agency. Preventive medicine physicians work in all of these areas and more. Physicians work not only in these agencies that I talked about, but they also work in the military. All across the United States, they work in these large health systems that the military runs. And in addition, they work in academics, and also in the industry, whether it's in the pharmaceutical industry or other industries, particularly looking after the well-being of employees there.
Well, it's a really, I think we've seen more of the importance of looking at health from a population level. Do you sense that there's a greater recognition of the important role that preventative medicine plays?
I wish I could say yes to that, Ron. But preventive medicine, unfortunately, gets short shrift. Let's start with residency funding. Avedis Dhanabedian talked about the three-step process: structure, process, and outcome, right? The structure is fundamentally flawed. I'm also a family physician. But when I went through my residency at the Stony Brook School of Medicine, that residency funding came from the federal government through monies from Medicare. Pediatrics is the same. OBGYN is the same. All these other specialties get funded through there. In preventive medicine, there were 69 residency programs. Only 19 are funded by the federal government, the Health Services Administration. And as a result, these residencies have to chase money. And in fact, two closed last year, and two more will be closing this year, including perhaps the most important one that had been around for decades, the one at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And yes, you would think post-pandemic, we would recognize the value of preventive medicine physicians, but unfortunately, this is not true. That structure hasn't changed. And so when you don't have a change in the structure, you have a systematic underfunding of residency programs all across this country, the value placed on preventive medicine is just not there.
You mentioned the funding challenges, which are really interesting, and it almost feels completely the opposite of what we should have coming out of a pandemic, where you'd think there'd be a greater appreciation for population health than ever before. Just from incoming students, I mean, is this something where medical students have shown an interest? I mean, is this something where you see more aspiring physicians maybe coming in, wanting to maybe move into preventive medicine? Because I would think after the pandemic, even with the funding challenge, you might said that there might be an interest among students to pursue that field.
There is a growing interest in students. The limiting factor, though, is the number of residency slots available. And no matter how interested or how much they may want to go into preventive medicine and public health, if they are unable to get into a residency because of a lack of funding, then they can't get trained there. And in particular, this is an issue when you think of the types of students who may be attracted to preventive medicine. We have noted that the American College of Preventive Medicine, there's a disproportionate interest in preventive medicine from medical students of color. They're interested in going into serving in their local communities at a population level. But again, there are insufficient slots that are funded for these medical students to go on once they graduate medical school to become preventive medicine doctors across the country. And that is a limiting factor. It's not that people aren't interested, it's simply that people can't be trained.
And it strikes me as a real, troubling situation on another level, because I mean, there's, as you already articulated, there's a crying need for more people to be working in preventive medicine. But on the other hand, it's a time when we need more doctors in general, and especially preventive medicine, it's such an important mission. But what I've heard, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, it's also a field where you can have maybe a little bit more of a life outside of work than maybe some other fields of medicine, where you can have a family without like having to, go without sleep for 18 years. Is that, I mean, that seems to be something that would be appealing to some folks in preventive medicine, the idea of doing something that's very meaningful, very important, but also not having to necessarily put aside goals of having a family as well.
That's true. The balance is there in preventive medicine. The interest is there in preventive medicine. The work that preventive medicine physicians do across this country is work that is both interesting and important. That's what we talk about in the work that we do. You get to work on bringing new drugs to market. You get to work at the FDA to maybe regulate those drugs. When there is an outbreak on a ship, it's the preventive medicine docs who meets the ship at the docks, let's say in San Diego or in Florida, there's an outbreak of norovirus. And so these are the doctors who go on. If you're in the military, there are physicians that are running large institutions. So preventive medicine doctors are doing work that is interesting and important, and they're very happy doing the work that they do. They do have, as you said, perhaps a greater balance in their life. And you look at surveys, there's a higher level of satisfaction in preventive medicine physicians above the average for physicians in this country. So it's not that people aren't interested. It's not that they're not happy with the work that they do. It's not that they're not satisfied with their life, but there's just an insufficient amount of funding to have more residencies be created. And the fact that by the end of this June, will have had four residency programs close shows that there is a significant challenge with funding, which is why when the American College has its Preventive Medicine 2024 meeting later on in April in Washington, D.C., we will be heading to Capitol Hill to try to lobby for more funding. And while funding has gone up incrementally, we need a lot more. This is not about evolution, it's about revolution. You need to fundamentally change and dramatically increase, perhaps by tripling the funding that exists now to what this country needs.
Are you getting a sense that lawmakers, policymakers are starting to recognize that need? I mean, do you get a sense that more people are getting that message that this is just an area that just requires more federal investment?
We are. Within the last federal budget, there is an increase in funding of about $900,000, so less than a million. And when you think about how infinitesimally small that amount is compared to the federal budget, you can smile or laugh at that. But it's an increase, and we're grateful for that. But if you're funding 20 or 19 out of 69 residency programs, you can do the math. You need to at least triple that. And that is where we're going. Instead of $1 million, you probably need well on the average of another $50 to $70 million to make sure that the number of medical students who are interested in this exciting field of preventive medicine can actually come and join. And then they can go out subsequent to being trained to work in the military, to work in rural areas, to work in state and local and federal agencies to make the health of the country better.
Which seems so important because there's just overwhelming data about the physician shortage in America. I think 100 million Americans don't have regular access to primary care. The Association of American Medical Colleges recently just came out with the new projections of a shortage of 86,000 physicians by the year 2036. So there's a shortage now, and it's only projected to get worse with the double whammy of more Americans getting older and a lot of people nearing retirement age as America kind of gets a little grayer. I mean, obviously there's a need for investment, but what else needs to be done to kind of tackle these physician shortages more broadly?
I think there are a number of things that need to be done. First and foremost, we should be looking at class size. All across the country, we have maybe about 150 medical schools. We've got MD and DO schools. We've got about this 150 medical schools. And what we have is just a small amount of the physicians that are needed that are graduating the med schools. First thing, there's a need for more physicians. And so we have that ability to do that. Why are the numbers of physicians being artificially kept low? You know, we look at countries and in many ways we malign them. Let's say countries such as Cuba and others that we may say, look, these are countries where they have significant personal restrictions. What they don't have is restrictions on the number of physicians. Cuba is one of the largest exporter of physicians around the world. And so perhaps we need to think about increasing the class size because we have insufficient numbers of physicians. In addition, when you look at the other aspect, there is this ethical dilemma where we in the United States recruit and put international medical graduates all across the country. And in fact, in the United States, more than 30% of all of the primary care physicians, so family medicine and internal medicine, more than 30% of these residency positions that were just filled last week in the match come from foreign countries. So there's an issue of a brain drain from those countries while we're trying to meet our needs. And in Tennessee and Illinois, those two states have passed legislation that cuts the requirements for international medical graduates, which is great for those particular graduates. They are coming for a better life. I too am an immigrant and I understand that. But at the same time, you're dealing with a brain drain of a highly valued resource of these physicians who are trained abroad and they come here, and that is a problem. The third is an issue of salary. When you look at the salary for primary care physicians and preventive medicine physicians, they can be a half to a third of the specialists that are at the top of the pay scale, such as cardiologists and orthopedic surgeons. And so, why is there such a huge disparity? A disparity that doesn't exist in almost any other country in the world. If you look at Europe, Western Europe, you're talking about Denmark, Sweden, you're looking at France or England, even looking at our neighbors above us in the north, Canada, you don't have such a huge disparity in how physicians are paid. And that is something that needs to be addressed. So the three themes that I think about: insufficient number of physicians, there must be a way to look at this. The AAMC, American Association of Medical Colleges, should be looking to increase the number of graduates. And you can't say that there are people who are not interested. Only about 42% of applicants to medical school get accepted. You can't say that those other 58% are not qualified. Okay, some may not be, but there needs to be a way to expand it. So it's insufficient class size. There is the issue of foreign medical grads or international medical grads, and there's a disparity in salary that makes it a problem where, as you said, more than 85 million people in the United States live in areas with insufficient access to primary care. And the other point you mentioned is retirement. People who have been working in public health and preventive medicine are older. They're going to be retiring. We know there's going to be this huge shortage in the public health workforce because folks who've been working there now for decades are retiring. We saw an increase in the retirement numbers with the pandemic, and a lot of physicians are also burnt out in the primary care world, and they're leaving the practice of clinical medicine to go do other things.
Well, you mentioned the aging of the physician workforce. I mean, according to AAMC data, one in five doctors right now are 65 or older, and another 22% are between the ages of 55 and 64. So you've got a lot of America's doctors that are either poised to retire or at least on the cusp of reaching retirement age.
Yeah, and you can't fix this quickly, right? It's going to take you 7 years to recruit people to a larger medical school class size, and then another 3 years minimum of residency. Even if so even if you start now, this is going to be a major problem going forward.
How important is it to also talk about reducing the costs of obtaining a medical degree? You hear about just the amount of debt that medical students are coming out of, which probably explains why some doctors shift towards the specialties that pay more, even if they might prefer preventive medicine or primary care, because if you can earn twice as more in a specialty, that helps you retire that six-figure debt that you're carrying. So how important is it to make it a little bit more manageable to pay for medical school?
I think we'll see more of that being played out. There are going to be two interesting experiments to watch. One is New York University School of Medicine, and the other is Albert Einstein University School of Medicine. Both of those are going to have tuition-free medical school classes. They have been endowed with significant sums of money, and so their medical students now no longer have to pay any tuition. It'll be interesting to see what comes out of those, what types of physicians come out of those medical schools. We do know that people who graduate medical school and finish a residency by the time they're done have an average debt of about 200,000. Think about that. You're 29, 30 years old. You have a $200,000 debt sitting on top of you. If you want to start a family, if you want to go out and look to get a house, you have this incredible burden. And that's not to complain that physicians aren't going to be paid well, but you've got an extra burden that you have to now deal with for the rest of your life. It may take 20, 30 years to pay off that debt. And those come with high interest rates, as you know. President Biden has looked to reduce the burden of student debt. And that is a significant factor once you start to look at, hey, I can become an orthopedic surgeon or cardiologist that pays between $500,000 and $750,000 a year, or I can be a primary care doc or a preventive medicine doc, and you're going to be paid about $220,000, $230,000. What do you choose? Are you going to choose, I'm going to follow my passion and I'm going to do what I want, which some of us have done with great satisfaction over a 30-year career? Or are you going to say, hey, I'm not going to worry about this. I can't make this choice for my family when I'm going to be unable to do what I want to do with the rest of my life. And so they make choices based on finances and the heavy burden of debt that they carry. And so going forward, it'll be interesting, as I said, to see what comes out, what types of physicians and what types of residencies are chosen by the medical graduates at NYU and Albert Einstein in New York.
Well, you mentioned finding your passion in preventive medicine. I'd love just to hear about, I always like to ask people the why they chose the path they did. So what led you into this field?
I'll go back a little bit further. I decided I want to become a physician when I was about 5 years old. My grandmother at the time had suffered a heart attack, and I went to the hospital and I saw her, and I knew this is what I wanted to do. So I'm one of those folks who knew always what I wanted to do. And by the time I was 24 and I graduated medical school at Stony Brook, I was happy to go into a specialty which was family medicine. which growing up in Guyana, I had seen there was a legendary physician there, Dr. Fredericks, and he was my family doc. And I go, well, that's what I want to do. But then midway through my residency, I kept seeing patients with the same issues. So smoking, obesity, lack of exercise, diabetes. These are the types of things that now underlie what we call lifestyle medicine. And there's a very famous medical article published in 1990, the year I got out of medical school. It's published in JAMA. And it's written by Dr. Michael McGuinness and Dr. William Foggy. They were respectively the heads of the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion in Washington, D.C., and the CDC in Atlanta. And what they wrote in that article was the actual causes of death. And it was tobacco use, being sedentary, improper nutrition, lack of exercise. And from there, you now have a field of lifestyle medicine. At the time, I went into preventive medicine because I thought, well, maybe if we could decrease tobacco use, which is responsible for the deaths of about 440,000 people every year in this country. Think about it, 1,000 people or more die every day in America because of tobacco use. If we can cut that down, if we can get people to move, if we can get them to eat properly, if we can make sure that they don't use the substances that can cause deleterious side effects, deleterious health effects, then there is an opportunity to really impact people. So it's not that I didn't value taking care of patients one on one. And I still love seeing patients and I do volunteer and see patients. But being able to impact on a broad scale a community, whether it was in Suffolk County in Long Island when I worked first in public health, later on I went into academics, and then much later on I went into the pharmaceutical industry. You know, bringing new products to market is an interesting thing. But when I think of my other colleagues who work in the military or who work in state or federal health departments, this is something that drives you. It is interesting and important work. It is an ability to impact the outcomes of the health of a lot of people, not just the 2,000 or so patients you may see in your private practice, but really it can be millions of people that you're working to help improve their quality of life. You know, I talked about structure, process, outcome. You need to fund more residencies. You need to have more medical students in the medical schools graduating. You then need to train them appropriately. But all of that is really only about the outcome. How do you make sure that patients live high quality, long lives? That's really what this is all about. Working for patients all across America to make sure that they can live the best quality life for as long as possible. Being functional is important. You want to have a country where people live well into their 80s, like the folks in Japan, like the folks in we call the blue zones. You want to make sure they live a long time, but also they're functionally able to do what it is that they want to do. They go to a granddaughter's wedding. They can attend the graduation of college of a grandson. You can only be able to do that if you're healthy and if you're able to function well. So not just being alive, not just surviving, but thriving. And that's what preventive medicine docs do, trying to help people live these long lives where they're able to function at a high level and have a wonderful quality of life.
Well, that sounds like a good segue to making the pitch to others. You talked about it a little bit already, but why would you just sell people on pursuing preventive medicine?
And I think this comes naturally. When one goes into med school, for the most part, you go into med school because you want to help people. And we have a medical student section, a resident physician section, and a young physician section within the American College of Preventive Medicine. And people are interested, medical students are interested in that. It is something that interests them inherently. We need to foster that interest. We need to show them the types of careers they can have and the impact they can have. and to learn about the opportunities to do interesting and important work. How much fun is it to be able to go to an outbreak of some particular disease? It's the preventive medicine docs who you can go back almost 50 years when you think of Legionnaires' disease, the outbreak in 1976 in Philadelphia. It's the preventive medicine docs who worked in that, or that really new unusual disease that was found in the 80s, turned out to be HIV, or the COVID-19 pandemic. Preventive medicine docs are at the forefront of these types of investigations. Or you're working in a pharmaceutical industry and you're bringing new products to market. Or you're working in the Los Angeles County Health Department and you're caring for millions of patients in that city to make sure that they have safe food, clean water, getting vaccinated appropriately. So these are the kinds of things that you will see preventive medicine docs doing. And if you go to acpm.org, you can see a new campaign we had started last year. This is preventive medicine. It tells you about a variety of opportunities that exist. And in many ways, we laughingly say to one another, if you know what one preventive medicine doc does, you know what one preventive medicine doc does. We work in such disparate areas and do such different things from, as I mentioned, academics to individual patient care to population care to the pharmaceutical industry to occupational health to aerospace medicine. And so these are, one of the recent astronauts was a preventive medicine doc. How cool is that? Okay, maybe that's the one that I'm talking about. But the point is, you have this broad choice of jobs and careers that are available to you, that people have this inherent interest in it. We certainly need to foster that at the American College of Preventive Medicine, the AAMC, and other medical organizations. But you can have more preventive medicine physicians if you don't have the funding for the residency programs to train them in the specialty.
Well, that's a really good sales pitch about the importance of and the excitement of preventive medicine as well. So, I mean, just a field where there's so much talk about health equity and closing disparities, and preventive medicine seems to be something at the very forefront of trying to address some of those goals of trying to give everybody the opportunity for better health care. So,
Absolutely.
excellent. Well, this time flew. So that was a great discussion. Flew kind of quickly, but Doctor, thanks so much for taking time talking with us today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And so did I, Ron. Thank you very much. And let's see what we can do to get more preventive medicine doctors out there practicing and helping to improve the healthcare system and making the healthcare of patients all across this great country better. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast by Chief Healthcare Executive. You can subscribe to Healthy Bottom Line wherever you get your podcasts. For the latest news, visit chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X, the platform formerly known as Twitter. For Chief Healthcare Executive, I'm Ron Southwick. Take care.